May it please the court, counsel. Rosanna Terramina on behalf of appellant Mr. Anthony Ferreri. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Ferreri raises three issues on appeal. The first issue challenges the district court's interpretation and application of United States Sentencing Guideline 3A1.1, subsection B1, which increased Mr. Ferreri's offense level by 2 points. By its own terms, Section 3A1.1 applies if a defendant knew or should have known that a victim of the offense was a vulnerable victim. The application notes define vulnerable victim as a person who is unusually vulnerable due to age, physical or mental condition, or who is otherwise particularly susceptible to criminal conduct. The words unusually and particularly are key, as they require comparison. Relation. As this enhancement is not to be applied in every case, it was not to be applied where the usual victim is at issue.
The government argues that this issue's been waived on appeal.
Because of an appellate waiver, Your Honor?
No, there's the fact that the plea agreement waived any challenge to the sentence, right?
Right. Your Honor, as far as the appellate waiver is concerned, I believe that the court's recent case in United States versus Godoy, and I can give the court that cite, actually is dispositive here. The Rule 11 colloquy in this case was similar to the colloquy in Godoy, where the district court, in light of an appellate waiver, did advise the defendant that he would be able to challenge an illegal sentence. And the court in Godoy said that the oral Rule 11 colloquy trumped any waiver in the appellate agreement. And I will say that I do think that the appellate waiver in this case is less than a model of clarity and should definitely be construed against the government as drafter. But focusing more on Godoy, which I do think is dispositive, in that case, the court said that if there was a statutory error that was alleged or something that would make the sentence lawfully incorrect, that the court's Rule 11 colloquy would trump. So I don't believe that there is an appellate waiver in this case. I don't believe that even before Godoy came out that the actual substance of the appellate waiver would allow, the appellate waiver language, I apologize, would allow an actual waiver in this case. It's very unclear. I don't believe that the court could find that it was knowing and voluntary. And again, in light of Godoy, I do think that that's dispositive here. The Godoy case's it's not been published yet. It was decided on February 5th of 2013, but it can be found at 2013 Westlaw 425334. On the substance of the vulnerable victim issue, 3A1.1 was meant only to apply to an exceptional case.
You say exceptional case, and in your brief you say other than the typical victims of the offense of conviction. What do you think what do you regard as the offense of conviction in this case?
Sure. Your Honor, but looking at the cases when...
What do you think they meant when they said offense of conviction?
I believe in this case,
yes.
We're talking about investment fraud.
Why? The crime that he was convicted of was mail fraud. That's right. So why should it be investment fraud?
Okay. Your Honor, because I think that in fraud, especially mail fraud, as compared to basically any other offense that is much more specific, like an assault offense or a physical offense and even offenses against children, general federal offenses, fraud, mail fraud, wire fraud in particular, are very, very broad. There is no typical victim of mail fraud because it
so that means that it's not built in. The part of the guidelines that you're relying on is the one that says do not apply Section B if the factor that makes the person vulnerable victim is incorporated into the offense guideline. And there's nothing incorporated into the fraud guideline about the kind of vulnerabilities at issue here. There might be something into the investment fraud guidelines. There might be something into, for example, in the Mann Act cases, it's assumed that the people who are being transferred across state lines are underage. With respect to the smuggling of aliens cases, it's expected that the victim will be an alien. But this is just fraud. It's not a particular kind of fraud.
Your Honor, I would say that looking at all of the cases that
not interested in the other circuits' cases, really, because they, notwithstanding the way you've characterized them, the government's characterized them, they all seem to really depend on the facts of the case. So I'm looking at, just for the moment anyway, I'm not interested.
Sure.
It's not quite exactly what I mean. But for purposes of this discussion, I want to know why we shouldn't be looking at the offense of conviction, which in this case is mail fraud.
Okay. Your Honor, because in that case, then, to me, any victim would be a vulnerable victim, any victim would be susceptible.
It has to be an unusually vulnerable victim, but doesn't have to be somebody who's particularly unusually vulnerable with respect to this kind of fraud. In fact, the guidelines have an example. Cancer fraud victims, having cancer makes you vulnerable. Now, that wouldn't be the case if we looked at it only as cancer fraud, because every cancer fraud victim has cancer. So how is that distinguishable?
Certainly, but if, and I resist doing this because you want me to resist doing this, but I think that crime is can be defined more broadly as fraudulent solicitation, which would make someone more vulnerable to someone with cancer more vulnerable.
But we're going to if we were to adopt the kind of rule you're talking about, we would never know how narrow or how wide to address the crime. It seems like the purpose of the guidelines is to prevent a kind of double counting, to not have victims who are vulnerable and whose vulnerability is already built into the guideline. And nobody's vulnerability is built into mail fraud. Mail fraud is a broad general crime. If you are particularly vulnerable because you're old, because you're sick, because you're inexperienced, because your husband just died, if for any of these reasons, and particularly in combination, you're vulnerable, then I don't see anything in these guidelines to suggest that that person isn't vulnerable.
But then anyone could be vulnerable. Anyone who is a victim of the crime could be vulnerable.
No, anyone who, and they purposely give examples, vulnerable due to age, physical or mental condition, or who is otherwise particularly susceptible.
Well, let's replace with the cancer example. Let's replace cancer victim with someone who is bald or overweight. So in that case, is someone to be unusually vulnerable to the marketing of a particular potion that is supposed to cure baldness or a particular pill that is supposed to cure weight loss simply because they are bald or overweight?
Well, how do you distinguish cancer then?
Because Your Honor, in the cases, there's actually a dichotomy in the cases. There seems to be two branches of vulnerability. There's vulnerability due to mental capacity and physical capacity when you're talking about a physical crime. But there's also, when we talk about cancer and similar investment fraud schemes, we're talking about people who are particularly desperate. And I think in that case, the cases talk about desperation,
that these people were more desperate. Have that situation here. We have people
right.
who are, according to the judge, were old, unable to understand what was happening to them, who placed their trust. I don't see why that wouldn't count here.
But Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with the conclusion that there was any finding that these people didn't understand what was happening to them. Mrs. Reutemann, in particular, one of the three people who was relied upon, called Mr. Ferrari over and over and over again. And in fact, I would say that if there was an example of diminished mental capacity here, something above just age or I'm an unsophisticated investor, there still needs to be comparison here. There's no, even though they might be an unsophisticated investor, it doesn't mean that they're less sophisticated investors. And
how can that be? And if they're unsophisticated, there are obviously sophisticated investors out there.
Yes, there are, but that doesn't mean that they are typical victims of even if you define it as fraud. We're talking about people who are susceptible to a crime. Judge Wilkinson in the Wilson case specifically said people, and in that case was a mail fraud case. He defined the crime in that case as fraudulent solicitation because it was the brand of fraud that was perpetrated in that case. And in that case, he said, of course, people are going to target their solicitations to people who they believe are going to make the crime successful. Otherwise, there would be no crime.
There's not a single citation to anything in that case for that proposition. He does say that, but doesn't cite any, not another case, not the guidelines, just what we believe, whatever that the Fourth Circuit believes. We need a little bit more than just the fact that another respected circuit has come out this way. And I would have to say that it seems to me that what really motivated the court in that case was that solicitations were sent out randomly in that case. They were not aimed at particular individuals. They were just sent out randomly to an entire community, some of whom maybe were affected by the tornado, some of whom weren't, but they were sent out randomly. The defendant in this case did not do this randomly.
Right.
In our case.
Yes, Your Honor, but those solicitations were not, they were fraudulent solicitations trying to send out from everyone in an area that everyone did experience the hurricane. And
everybody,
he thought that they would be more.
Everybody in Raleigh may have experienced a hurricane, but not every person in Raleigh was damaged in that way by the hurricane.
Right, but that's not the solicitation.
The court emphasizes, with respect to that it was random. He uses the word random intentionally.
I don't read Wilson to either rise or fall on the fact of the knowing prong of the vulnerable victim enhancement. What's involved here is it wasn't a fraudulent solicitation trying to take advantage of people who had lost in the hurricane. It wasn't that at all. It was the defendant was purporting to be a reverend and saying, you know, I have lost, please help me. And he was soliciting funds from them and trying to play on their sympathies. So in that sense, he knew that the people of Raleigh would be sympathetic.
They weren't particularly vulnerable.
Yes.
And in our case, they are particularly vulnerable in a whole different set of ways.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that any of there are three things that the court and the government rely on to define vulnerability in this case. Age alone cannot stand alone to
maybe
say that
not,
these people
but it is
are
one
vulnerable.
Of the specific things that the guidelines tells us to look at.
Absolutely, and Your Honor, what's
it doesn't say age and something else. It specifically says to look at age. And
yes,
these
Your
people
Honor.
Are over what 84 or something, right?
One of them was 84, I believe. One was 82, and one was 75. Right. I do want to say 3A1.1 is a universal enhancement. It applies to every crime, not just fraud. So what's important about the call out of age is the fact that yes, age would make someone particularly vulnerable to a physical crime, to an assault crime, to if they were, but if it was a healthy older person, I don't know that there could be a finding that person was unusually vulnerable or particularly susceptible.
What's your best case other than Wilson?
I believe Lee, actually, I believe it's a Tenth Circuit case. It's fairly good. There's there's good language in a great deal of the cases, and I agree with Your Honor to the extent that this law is messy. There's nothing clear in this circuit, and it does appear that people are applying things.
Well, almost every case where they've held it to not apply is one where the crime itself, that is not the crime as subdivided, as we would be doing here, but the actual name of the crime, the Mann Act, transportation across state lines for the purposes of prostitution, the alien smuggling, where the person is obviously an alien. Those are the ones that work your way, and appropriately so, I think, because those are ones where the victim is defined by the statute itself, and so whatever concern the Congress has about the victim or the sentencing guidelines, Sentencing Commission has been built in. But this seems different to me.
I don't believe, for, well, one, I don't believe that the district court identified, that the government identified any crime. It is the government's burden to prove that 3A1.1 applies. And whether or not it be investment fraud, whether it be fraudulent penny stocks, whether it be mail fraud, the government and the district court didn't recognize this comparative standard at all.
What case has required the government to do a survey of all the offenders in a particular crime and then figure out what vulnerable, no cases.
No, and I don't believe that that's required. I hope that the court doesn't hear me saying that, but I do believe that there should be evidence and discussion of what a typical victim of a particular crime is. And Your Honor, I would also add to one of my better cases, the Anderson case, which is a case that the district court relied on. And I would add that to my list of cases because of the procedural posture in that case. That case was a remand in which the court initially said, hey, wait a second, you didn't make, this sounds fishy. You didn't make a particularized findings. You didn't do, there wasn't a searching enough effort here. You just said, hey, sounds vulnerable, and you didn't make an individualized assessment. When the court came back in Anderson, there was any number of different things that did make the victims vulnerable.
They're pretty much all exactly what the court found in this case.
Except,
right? A combination of age, education, work experience, lack of investments, experience, right?
Education, work experience. Also, these people were found to be living in assisted living facilities that made them, and this is the government's own words in Murrill, that made them not only more susceptible, but more in need of societal protection.
So Murrill really doesn't fit this at all. It's exactly the example I was talking about before. It's robbery of a bank, and the victim is a bank teller. Well, obviously, the offense builds in the fact that most of the victims of a robbery of a bank are bank tellers. So that's and not only is that an obvious case, it's now built directly into the guidelines. They give that as an example of somebody who's not.
That's true, Your Honor. But in making its argument, the court didn't make, the government made broader arguments. It cited cases that involved fraud cases. It involved other cases that were much more broad than the robbery to bank teller example. That was a very clear case, especially in light of the application note, which was written at the time.
I think wasn't it added as a result of that case?
I think that the application note may have actually been there already. I apologize if that's not correct, but. That being the case, the Solicitor General's brief is broader than that. It cites cases, including Wilson, that make a broader statement. And I believe that the courts universally and the government believe that there needs to be a comparison to the typical victim. That was not, there was no acknowledgement that needed to be done here. And I really do.
What's our standard of review on that, on
sure.
This issue? Because it does seem that inexperienced investors was one of the factors relied on, and that seems a reasonable factor for the court to rely on applying this. So what's our standard of review?
Well, yes, Your Honor, I'll say two things. The standard of review, it depends how this court looks at it. If framed, as I believe that it is, that the district court interpreted the guideline incorrectly in not recognizing this comparative standard at all, then I think that the review needs to be de novo, as that's a legal question, and then should be remanded to the district court for application of the correct standard.
Right. What if the district court applied a standard that took into account the comparison?
Then I believe that's due deference to the court's application of the guidelines to.
So you don't think it's clear error? That's the test. And this is a factual finding that the person is particularly vulnerable. Isn't that a factual decision?
It is, but it also does involve the application of the guidelines to facts found.
you could say that.
So it's a legal conclusion.
But if we get into that, it's deferential, however we formulate it.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. And briefly, I'd like to say, as far as the inexperienced investors, in this case, in any case, fraud, however you define this, there is no evidence in this case, or I don't believe universally, that the general public as a whole consists of experienced investors.
No, but there are obviously lots of experienced investors who get ripped off all the time. And what this case involves is some inexperienced or unsophisticated investors, and that seems to fall within at least the broad parameters of this guideline, and therefore application of that broad standard to this case doesn't seem, if it's a deferential standard, it doesn't seem so outlandish or incorrect as to rise above, rise to the level that we would reverse it.
Depending on what the applicable law is.
Right, I agree with you. If it's a legal error, I agree, then we look at that de novo. But if it's, here's a flexible standard, a broad standard, and how it's applied to a particular case and their inexperienced investors, it seems to me we give some deference to that, and the district court clearly did point that out, including in the final summary where the district court talked about the basis for his conclusion.
So, and that rule would basically require that in any investment fraud, any case involving investment fraud, if there were inexperienced investors, then those people would qualify as unusually and particularly susceptible victims. And I just think that is a broad rule that this court should not set. And when this is an exceptional.
Well, it's not just that here, but that seems to me a key part of it. That there is age, as Chief Judge Garland pointed out, and that's specifically identified.
It is.
I take your point on the age. I resist relying on age here too.
Well, as did the judge in this case. There are, I mean, if you look at age, that some people are more experienced investors because of their age. It doesn't change their. We don't know anything about these victims' education levels. We don't know anything about their ability to comprehend. There is no allegation that any of them were suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's or had any other diminished mental capacity. So in some sense, relying on age at all in this case without more really is meaningless. I do think the trust in the only other thing.
Just to nail this down, your complaint about that is really that would sweep too broadly.
I do. I think that there is no evidence that the general public is made up of inexperienced investors. And Your Honor, you're absolutely right. It's not to say that an experienced investor couldn't have been caught by this scheme. There could be an experienced investor who is simply too busy and wasn't paying attention to his statements.
So that's a different kind of argument. That's actually the argument that was raised below. The argument raised below was that, well, he could have fooled anybody. That's different than the argument you're making here, isn't it? The argument he made below was the conduct, they weren't uniquely susceptible to Mr. Furr. I'm reading from the objections to the pre-sentence report. Any person can be lied to. Any investor who had minimal investment experience, trusted his broker, would have fallen prey to this scheme. That's a different argument than you're making here, which is that these people are not more inexperienced than other people, are not more ill than other people, are not more trusting than. Isn't that a different argument?
They are two different arguments, but there needs to be, or they're related arguments. I take the point that they're not exactly the same, but there needs to be a nexus between the vulnerability and the crime. And so,
what I ask is whether standard of review shouldn't be plain error then if they're different arguments.
Well, Your Honor, I think the issue was certainly raised before the district court.
It was, but in the Baker case in which you folks participated, we applied the rule, the plain error, where the argument about vulnerability was different than the argument, that is, the argument below, was different than the argument on appeal.
I know that there is precedent. There may be two different arguments here. I do believe that the nexus argument is certainly related to whether or not these people are particularly susceptible to this particular crime. And that really is the argument here. And it depends how one defines the particular crime. So if this, there's nothing about these people who that makes them particularly susceptible to this crime. And that does go to the nexus argument. This crime could have fooled anyone. The actions, again, concentrating on Mrs. Roitman, because I think that that's important, she was the one who was hospitalized, and the district court made a specific finding that Mr. Ferrari was not aware of that hospitalization or could not find that Mr. Ferrari was aware of that hospitalization. So that is important. I don't believe that the government can rely on her hospitalization as a factor.
The court does say Mr. Ferrari does not dispute that he was aware of health issues, and he was aware that some investors had suffered death, especially of significant others or spouses.
Right, Your Honor, but none of the three people upon which the court relied or had any evidence in front of them actually did suffer any health issues there was no finding of that anyone particular suffered.
Especially those three snapshots of the individual. She's just not saying she's relying only on those three.
I don't know where else in the record there is evidence that anyone else suffered an illness. Yes, Mr. Ferrari could say, yes, I'd be aware if someone suffered an illness. And he did say it would have to be a terminal or a very serious illness, but then there was no evidence of anyone in particular. At that point, I would think that there would have to be some identification of someone who did suffer an illness so that there could be an examination of whether or not Mr. Ferrari did have knowledge of that particular vulnerability. That goes to the knowledge prong of the requirement. So I think that relying on illness on this record has to be out the window. I think that the only three things that the court identified that it relied upon and that there's evidence of are age, are lack of investment experience, and trust in one's broker, which we haven't discussed at all. But I don't believe because that is that trust in one's broker is taken into account in the offense guideline itself under 2B1.1, that guideline specifically says, or I'm says that, or I'm sorry, 3A1.1 says that you don't take into account it's the double counting argument that you can't take. 3A1.1 instructs courts not to apply the vulnerable victim enhancement if the fact that makes the person vulnerable is incorporated into the offense guideline. So we're not, then it would be the trust part. So I think right now it sounds like we're boiled down to inexperienced investors, and that's all we have here.
Well, we'll ask the government whether they boil down. Anybody else have any questions? No. Okay, thank you. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the court, Peter Smith on behalf of the United States. Even if this court were to reach the merits of appellant's challenge to the vulnerable victim adjustment in this case, there was no error. The district court specifically referenced a variety of factors and made findings about those factors, and under this court's precedent and other courts as well, that level of findings is sufficient for this court to affirm the judgment of the district court. The court listed a number of different factors. Those included age, the client's trust in appellant, health problems, lack of knowledge, and the victims were appellant's clients, his personal relationship with his clients, which he exploited in the course of his investment scheme. The court listed each of those factors, and under Baker, for example, and other cases, that's sufficient for a finding. Appellant never requested a direct comparison, never requested findings about the nature of a typical victim, to the extent that appellant is suggesting that the court should have engaged in that endeavor, that should be reviewed for plain error. And again, as I suggested, in any event, there is no error, which I believe is ultimately the holding in Baker. Although Baker applied plain error, I think that what the court found there was that there was no error, because even under the test suggested by the defendant in Baker, which is the same one as here, the court found that this court found that the district court's finding in that case was sufficient to show, even under that test, a vulnerable victim.
You said even if it's properly before us. You want to respond to the counsel's argument on that?
I think what counsel is arguing is that during the Rule 11 colloquy, the district court made an additional pronouncement about the nature of the waiver in saying that
Can you get past that?
I think so. I think that an illegal sentence is a term of art. I think that what that means is a sentence that exceeds the statutory maximum or has some other fundamental.
Isn't a question what it means to the defendant? Not what it means to, because frankly, I don't know what it means. So I would assume, therefore, that the defendant would be entitled to think it means something more broadly than above statutory maximum.
I think not in the context of this case, Your Honor, because in the context here, he stipulated to an offense level that would include this adjustment.
Right, but the colloquy is very important for making sure that all of that's understood, and the colloquy gets a little deviates a bit from the terms. If the judge had just reiterated those terms, I'm with you, but there's something more than that. As Chief Judge Garland points out, illegal sentences could mean a lot of things.
It could, and appellant was advised by experienced counsel in this case. He didn't raise any questions about the court's comments.
The problem with that is the district court's then essentially reassuring the defendant, who's probably got a lot to digest, and reassuring, oh, you can challenge an illegal sentence. Isn't that a problem then to say that this kind of argument's waived? At least under the recent precedent?
Again, I think not in the context of this case for the reasons that I stated, but it's not whether this court actually finds the appeal wholly waived or whether this court applies any other standard of review. There was no error, so right. It's really, in our view, not necessary to the court's resolution of this case.
And due deference is the standard of review? Or?
The court made a number of findings, and those findings would be reviewed for clear error. I mean, each finding that the victims were of this age or that the victims had health problems and that those kinds of
historical fact findings, I agree, for clear error. But how about the ultimate determination that they were vulnerable for purposes of this provision? What kind of standard of review for that? Due deference, right?
Well, yeah, I guess two responses. One is plain error because appellant never requested findings.
Assuming it was raised.
Assuming that it's preserved, it would be the ultimate disposition would be reviewed for deferentially for abuse of discretion, but that the factual findings would be reviewed for clear.
The embedded historical, I got it.
Correct, okay. Correct. But the ultimate, the sentencing is ultimately reviewed for reasonableness if it's in a challenge that's preserved. That's Gall and Rita say that,
counsel's trying to get de novo review by articulating this as a misunderstanding of the law by the district court. You want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think not. I think that not here because, as we said, sentences are reviewed for reasonableness, and this issue of what the proper test is and whether the court
agree that a misunderstanding of the guidelines would be reviewed de novo, right? A misinterpretation of the guidelines.
The meaning of the guideline would be reviewed de novo, Your Honor, because that's a purely legal question. Would always be reviewed de novo. But in the context of this case, the court wouldn't be applying that standard because appellant never really raised this issue in the proper way. He didn't request findings as to different pools of victims. So that would be reviewed for plain error. And the test that appellant is urging on appeal was never really contested in the trial court. The government's position was simply that you have so many factors that under the government was making a factual argument that these are vulnerabilities, and the court made factual findings based on that. Appellant argued this test to the district court, and the district court never said that's not the test, and it was never really disputed by the parties. So what the district court did was say, look, I understand that that's the test, and that test, it didn't say it in exactly this way, but defense counsel raised this issue. He said, look, the test is you've got to talk about the victim. You've got to talk about the victims of this particular offense. And the court said, well, yeah, even if we set aside age, you still have a number of other factors, including health problems. And I think that that colloquy is around Appendix 134 or 135. It's listed in the government's brief. But the court's response when appellant's attorney argues that the focus really should be on victims of this offense is to say, yeah, but these victims had health problems. They had other factors such as age.
So assume it's someone who's old and has no deterioration mentally. Why should age be at all relevant?
Well, as the court suggested earlier, it is listed in the guidelines themselves.
I understand that, but I'm not sure it makes sense as to a non-physical crime unless there's some showing of deterioration mentally. As counsel pointed out, people who are elderly are very often sophisticated investors, but even putting that aside, if there's no evidence of mental deterioration, I don't see how age is relevant at all.
I would agree that certainly it itself is not necessarily dispositive. Certainly,
relevant. You changed my relevant.
Well, and I do have. I could come back. I do have a response to you, Judge Kavanaugh. I'm sorry, Judge Garland.
Oh, go ahead. No, I was just going to ask the same. When you changed the words, I was wondering.
Relevant. Why is it relevant? Someone's 88 years old, but no mental deterioration. I don't see age being relevant for this kind of case.
Congress and the Sentencing Commission have indicated that it is relevant, and within this particular facts of this case.
Is that rational?
I think so. And even
someone's old but no mental deterioration, why is it rational for that to be a factor?
Well, they're simply saying that that's a factor. They're not saying that that's.
Why is it rational for it to be a factor if there's no mental deterioration?
I guess they've made a sort of implicit finding
they've
that.
They've made an assumption that's not supported by the real world, is that people who are old are unusually vulnerable, which is not accurate for this kind of crime unless there's some showing of mental deterioration.
Well, here you did have that evidence, though. So, I mean, even if we set aside whether Congress
had
a
different argument.
I understand.
I just want to tease out the age thing I find problematic.
Okay, two really short responses. One is that you did have that evidence here because you have particular people who were elderly and also had health problems, but defense counsel conceded during sentencing that age was a factor. His argument was it wasn't dispositive, and the district court said, yeah, that's correct, but here's a whole bunch of factors. And defense counsel, and when pinned down by the district court, defense counsel said, yes, age is a factor that the court must consider, along with some of the other factors that appellant is now contesting.
Just to follow up on this, so the guidelines specifically say age, physical, or mental condition, indicating that the guidelines do not consider the physical condition as part of age or mental condition as part of age. These are independent factors according to the guidelines.
Correct. For example, the guidelines would submit that somebody who has some sort of mental disability, for example, would be captured within
the
guidelines.
Right. So Alzheimer's is not a function of the age factor, but of the mental condition factor.
It could.
And when that question is asked whether that's rational, I guess there are two possible answers. One is you're going by general broad classifications, and they're entitled to do on the theory that we don't have to actually prove a mental condition problem. If you show old age, then it's not irrational to conclude that somebody's 84 may be more susceptible. But the other question is, are there any cases that say where the guidelines are irrational, a court can ignore them?
Not that I'm aware.
Particularly since Booker, where the courts can ignore them if they want to anyway.
They can. But I'm not aware of any such case. I mean, the sentencing guidelines in Congress have indicated that age is a factor, but as we argued in our brief, that was not the only factor the district court looked at in the context.
The guideline seems to say that age is a factor in a circumstance where you have a crime where age might be reasonably considered to be a factor. It doesn't say you have to consider age as a factor in every respect to every crime. It's absurd here. It makes no sense. You're saying we should write an opinion that says you have to consider age in every case. That's absurd. And that's not what Congress or the sentencing guidelines say.
It's not what the district court said either, is it?
No, it said that age wasn't the only factor, that it was.
The question we're asking you, why is it relevant at all here, at all in this case?
Well, I think it is, given, I guess, the second half of my response to Judge Kavanaugh is the one I'll stick with, that even if you set aside whether the Sentencing Commission or Congress had a basis for its determination, you had evidence in this case of these particular victims, of appellant's victims, having some degree of either inexperience in investing or some sort of diminished capacities. And defense counsel.
To do with age.
Well, defense.
Young people have diminished capacity.
That's true. And
I don't know what you're talking about. Age, you're going around in a circle.
Well,
why is age relevant here?
The defense counsel.
It may be relevant with respect to certain crimes. There's nothing to indicate that it's relevant with respect to this crime. And there are no findings that I can find in any event to suggest that the district court pointed to something to show that age, as distinguished from age and something else, was relevant.
Well, defense counsel conceded that it was relevant.
Doesn't matter. We're not going to write an opinion because defense counsel concedes something that's absurd under the law.
And
we wouldn't write it that way. At least I hope we won't.
I'm
not going to say the law is X, which is absurd, and the reason we're saying this is because defense counsel conceded it. So why don't we not do that? I'm just curious as to why you think age is relevant in this case.
Well, I guess
the answer is not because defense counsel conceded it.
Or because of, sounds like the court's.
Congress did not say that in every case with respect to every crime, age will be relevant. At least I don't see that. It could be a factor in with respect to certain crimes.
And I think
that's the most that you get out of this.
And, Your Honor, I think that that's what the district court did and said. I think that's consistent with what it said. And I think
I keep hearing you argue the district court found age here. And I'm saying, well, so what?
Well, it found
there
it was.
There were some old victims. So what? Why is that relevant?
But even if we set aside that factor in this case, you still had many other factors the district court relied upon.
We're getting a little bit closer now.
Right.
Closer to an answer, perhaps.
An answer that makes some sense.
Well, you had.
Age was quickly linked, right, to inexperience here.
It was. And the fact that these were appellant's own clients who trusted him, who he knew, who had been recommended by friends to appellant.
With age. Inexperience has nothing to do with age.
Many of those things don't have.
None of them do. I keep
that. Not necessarily.
Well, if there's an answer, give it to me. But it's not there. I can't stand you. You keep not arguing a point that's not relevant.
Well, it's not determinative in this case.
It's not
anyway.
Relevant in this case, which we asked 30 minutes ago.
Well, I mean, my answer is my answer. The court isn't accepting it, but.
No, Congress did not say what you said. Congress did not say that we must consider age as a factor in every case with respect to every crime.
It's You're saying
it would be among the factors that you could look at.
I think I agree with that, and I think that that's what the district court did here. Other courts have done the same.
The question then becomes, why is it relevant in this particular case? And I have trouble thinking it is particularly relevant. Although I think some of the other factors identified by the district court, as I've indicated, are quite likely relevant. So I just want to raise. Reflexive reliance on age in this kind of case strikes me as questionable. So I know there are going to be more cases like this.
I understand, and I don't think the district court did reflexively rely. I mean, it when defense counsel raised this issue, it said, "Look, I'm not looking only at age. I'm looking at these other factors." And other courts have said, in the context of investment schemes, that age certainly is a factor. The Eighth Circuit, for example, which the district court cited in the Anderson case, I believe it's Anderson that says. Where you have somebody investing their retirement savings, you have somebody.
Right.
Maybe what it comes down to at the end of the day is where you have a constellation of factors that you have a vulnerable victim. I mean, all of the cases that cited by the district court, Fort Shelley, Anderson, have all found that where you have these factors, They've all found vulnerable victims, and I guess at the end of the day, that's all this court needs to find, where you have a constellation of different factors. So, I mean, I understand what the court's saying.
Before we let you go, I want to ask another question about this appellate waiver issue with respect to the plea, since the colloquy may eliminate it for this case, but I imagine we're going to see the same plea deal again. I don't understand the government's position that this was not outside of the stipulated offense. First sentence of the waiver says, it is agreed that your client will not file a direct appeal of any sentence outside the stipulated offense level.
Right.
And the defendant's position is that a offense level of 30 is outside the is not outside the stipulated offense level of 29 or 31.
Right.
So how do you get it? How do you get a 30 outside 29 or 31?
If I understand the court's,
you say that they're precluded from appealing because it's outside the stipulated offense level.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
The stipulated offense level is 29 or 31. 30 seems smack dab in the middle.
Seems like you're hyper-literalism.
Yeah, perhaps, and maybe the better argument is the one that we also made in our brief, which is even if it's within the guidelines, appellant stipulated that a within guidelines
if it's
level is reasonable.
Now, I can ask, since you are a lawyer, what is the technical meaning of reasonable under the case law?
I think that reasonable in the case law, and also for purposes of the plea agreement and where the parties intend, and for purposes of the parties intend.
Well, I'm willing to go technical with you here.
Okay,
I'll just read you
technical.
From Gall versus United States, which is the leading Supreme Court opinion on this precise issue, which is that significant procedural error, such as improperly calculating the guideline range, which is what the defendant alleges here, is different from a view of the substantive reasonableness of the decision. So that seems to me that as long as the defendant is not challenging the substantive reasonableness, which the defendant is not, but rather is making a procedural argument of miscalculation, that they have not agreed to either a within or a without of the guidelines position. So it seems to me you've written yourself into a plea agreement that doesn't protect you in this circumstance.
Why
is that wrong?
I think not, Your Honor, because this court has also talked about procedural reasonableness as being a component of reasonableness. And in any event, here, this was a stipulated guideline range. So you have that added factor. It's almost like
what you want to say is you can't appeal any sentence, why don't you say you can't appeal any sentence? Now, we may not let you do that, but at least we would know where the boundary of this is. But it doesn't seem to be within this boundary at all.
Well, I think procedural reasonableness is a manner of reasonableness, and that Gall and Reed are consistent with that. But here it's the court's task.
We've said that since then, right?
You have, and there's a case cited in the government's.
Although, to pick up on Chief Judge Garland's question, I don't know why you'd write it this way. I mean, that's for future reference as well.
I understand, and I guess my response is it's this court's task to carry out the intent of the parties applying contract principles and not.
Well, how do we know what the defendant's intent of that? The defendant obviously doesn't think this was the intent.
Well, so, he doesn't now, but at the time he stipulated to a level that would include the vulnerable victim adjustment, and that's really the bottom line of our waiver argument. He stipulated to a level that could include the vulnerable victim adjustment.
But he objected to the – he said he was going to object to it, right? That's included
he did,
also.
And he reserved argument to the district court. But
at the district court level.
Right, at the district court. But he said, look, whatever – I mean, this is the way we interpret the agreement. Whatever the district court does with respect to the vulnerable victim enhancement, we won't appeal that. The parties can't agree. We're going to submit that to the district court for resolution, but we won't appeal that.
It would have been a lot easier if that's what he said, if that's what the agreement said.
Perhaps. But
you
again,
it gets there through multiple steps.
It does, and it, again, applying contract principles, it's the party's intent that's controlling. If there are no further questions.
Applying review principles, it might be well for you to tell those in your office that there are at least three judges who didn't know what you were talking about.
I'll pass that along, Your Honor. Thank you. We urge the court to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you very much.
How much time? All right, we'll give you an extra couple minutes. Come on.
I'll be quick, Your Honor. I just wanted to point out the fact that there's an inconsistency in the government's argument regarding plain error review and or what review applies to this case. In saying that plain error review applies in arguing that de novo review doesn't apply and that the court did apply the correct standard, the government specifically said, well, defense counsel argued the same argument or made the same argument below, and therefore the court clearly recognized the correct standard and applied that standard. But now the government's saying, well, wait, plain error.
Sorry to interrupt, but that would get you out of plain error, but still a deferential review, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Right. But I'm also talking about de novo in this case as well. So if we're looking at just the legal standard, that would be reviewed de novo.
You're arguing de novo review, just to tease this out. I think what the government was saying is your argument on that is different.
But that would be de novo review of what standard applies, which is the recognition of unusually vulnerable and particularly susceptible. And my understanding of what the government's argument was that, of course, the court understood what the correct standard was because the defense counsel made that exact argument below. So that's all that I'm pointing out, and I do believe that defense counsel preserved the argument.
And your argument about comparison, about how there has to be some evidence of the comparison, does the defendant have to have made that comparison himself at the time he committed the crime? Does he have to have done a survey of which people are particularly vulnerable and which people aren't to this particular kind of crime?
No, courts have said that the defendant doesn't need to target victims because of their vulnerability. He simply needs to know
the provision says who is that the defendant has to know or should have known of the victim's unusual vulnerability. And if you're saying unusual vulnerability means in comparison to the population, does he have, just like you think that the district court needs to have made some complete comparison across the board, does there have to be the evidence that the defendant wrote down a little notebook like, oh, most of the people who I could target with respect to this are this age, but I'm going to target only these people? How do we make sure that both sides of the equation, that is the knowledge part and the vulnerability part, match up?
If the court decides that the particular vulnerability qualifies under 3A1.1, I think legally, then the only question for the court would be whether or not the defendant knew or should have known of that vulnerability. The targeting, even though I would love the targeting aspect to be in this case, I think that that's more favorable language, but it's not anymore in the application note that has been amended. I want to resist as much as possible defining this crime as mail fraud broadly, because I think that it renders the words unusually vulnerable and particularly susceptible completely meaningless.
It doesn't. For this crime, you have a problem. You pick a vulnerable person, they're going to be particularly vulnerable with respect to mail fraud. If you pick securities fraud if that's the crime the person pleads to, it's a different matter. If crime against aliens, then it's a different matter. But if the conviction is just generic mail fraud, which doesn't include, I mean, the theory of the guidelines was they looked at all the people in the past who had been sentenced over a particular kind of crime. And when you have a broad generic crime like mail fraud, no account was taken into of the vulnerability. So pretty much any vulnerability is a particular vulnerability for mail fraud, while it might not be for something else.
That may be correct, and that's the reason to, in some sense, resist this.
Why should we resist what the Sentencing Commission tells us to do?
Because in any case, there's by definition, there's a crime, there's a victim. This is supposed to be directed at an unusual victim or someone who is particularly susceptible, not just simply susceptible. I mean, otherwise there wouldn't be a crime. There would be no victim there if you defined it that way. And so I think that it's, if you read those words out of the guideline and recognizing that that guideline applies to any number of crimes, then there really is no meaning in the context of a crime like mail fraud, like wire fraud.
On your susceptible, particularly susceptible, why wouldn't you say that all people are susceptible, but inexperienced investors are particularly susceptible?
Because it's who are the typical victims of the crime. So all people, not all people might be susceptible at all, in fact.
Well, you had just said that that would cover everyone susceptible.
No, all victims.
Right.
All victims. So not I would think all victims are susceptible, mm-hmm. but not everyone is susceptible.
Well, everyone's susceptible to certain kinds of crimes, right?
And then, so then, if that's the case, then I would think that would render this
meaningless. Your point was it has to be particularly susceptible. Well, it would seem to me, and this is semantics maybe, but it would seem to me inexperienced investors would be particularly susceptible, no? Meaning more susceptible than the usual.
I want to stress one thing before I sit down. I don't think that inexperience equals not intelligent. And I think that when we start drawing lines, that how experienced is this
person?
That's
true, but inexperienced, and that's true, but that doesn't mean you're not more susceptible to certain kinds of crimes if you're inexperienced. You don't know, you could be highly intelligent, but if you're completely inexperienced in something, you're going to make mistakes. And the theory of this is the defendant, will take advantage of those who are more likely to make mistakes, either because they're not intelligent or because they're inexperienced.
Well, in this case, there's just nothing to say that these people are less experienced. Maybe they're inexperienced, but less experienced than, again, the general public. There's nothing to say that they are less intelligent. We just don't have that. And if we apply the guideline in financial fraud cases to any case where someone doesn't have experience in investing, take age out of the equation, take everything else out of the equation, then that applies essentially to nearly every investment crime. Okay. But if there's nothing more, and especially with there are two other issues, if the court has any questions on those.
Can I ask the government counsel one question?
Of course. I'm afraid that...
I'm so...
Judge Kavanaugh would like
I
to
just
wanna,
pose I would just want to make one clarification. At the sentencing, when the district court said you probably retain the right to challenge any illegal sentence, that was in the colloquy.
Yes.
Did the government ever try to correct that?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Okay, we'll take the matter under consideration. Thank you very much.